So the work that I'll be presenting today was done with Nathanael Lindner, who was a postdoc at Caltech, and with Gil and Adi. There has been a follow-up work, which I won't talk about so much, which has been with Johannes Motruk, who's a student at Max Planck Dresden, and Ari Turner and Frank Pullman. There has been actually quite a few closely related works. I've listed some of them here. Some of them are by people who are actually sitting here. So this is a rapidly developing field. So we'll actually hear about this in this conference some more, I think. Recently there has been a lot of excitement in this field with the apparent discovery of Majorana zero modes in condensed matter systems. So since I'm attempting to do here is to sort of go beyond Majorana fermions or Majorana zero modes, let me just review this really quickly, or at least the aspects of this which are relevant to what I'm doing. So this is the setup. So we have a 1D wire, which can be a semiconducting wire, which is proximity coupled to a superconductor. Let me write down a simple model. So this is a tight binding model for spinless fermions, which are proximity coupled to a superconductor. So there's this induced chair field. And these are spinless fermions. So this has to be a P-wave type pairing. Now, it turns out that as simple as this problem is, it's quadratic, we can solve it exactly. The solution actually has some very interesting features. So let me mention some of them. So the bulk of the system is gapped, but there are actually two modes exactly at zero energy, which are bound to the edges of this 1D wire. And if you look at the many body ground state of the system, it turns out that there are two quasi-degenerate ground states, which correspond to a total number of electrons in the system, which is either even or odd. So the number of electrons is not conserved in the system because of this pairing field, but the parity of that number is conserved, just because you can put in or out Cooper pairs, but not single electrons. And it turns out that there are two states with a total parity of the fermion number being either even or odd, which are exactly degenerate. And this ground state degeneracy is actually topological in the sense that there's no local observable that you can measure to actually distinguish between these two states. So that's sort of an attractive feature. So it's kind of a degeneracy which is topological, so it's protected in some way. It could be useful for quantum information processing. And of course, we also want to be able to manipulate somehow this ground state degeneracy. And the way to do it that is braiding. So each one of these defects in the previous case, the edges of this wire, is sort of an anion. And there's an overall ground state degeneracy which is associated with these anions. And if we think about these defects as living in a 2D plane, you can braid them, so you can exchange them adiabatically. When you do that, the Hamiltonian of the system goes back to itself, but the ground state of the system doesn't have to go back to itself because of this ground state degeneracy. It undergoes some unitary transformation. Okay, so you can induce basically rotations within this ground state manifold. Now, for the particular case of Majorana fermions, this is the kind of unitary transformation that you induce. So in the presence of two of these defects, the ground state is twofold degenerate. And so this matrix U is a 2x2 unitary matrix, and it's actually given in this form. So the two states are the states with a total even and odd number of fermions in the system. Now, this all holds for defects in a 2D plane. So this was worked out for the case of vortices in a P+ AP superconductor by Reed and Green and Ivanov. It turns out that you can actually mimic the same kind of operation for edges of wires, of 1D systems. That's actually less obvious, but there has been this really beautiful work by Jason Alicia and collaborators that he showed that you can actually mimic braiding even for actually for a network of 1D systems. So Matthew was also involved in that. So, great timing. So right. So that's sort of my background. Now, sort of the question that I'll be raising in this talk is how can one go sort of beyond these Majorana fermions? Can one get some richer structure, specifically in a 1D system? So I have some sort of interacting 1D wire. Can I get a more interesting topological degeneracy and possibly a braiding statistics just from a 1D system? Okay, so can we get something richer than Majorana fermions in 1D? Turns out that there's a general answer. So there's kind of a theorem in quotes. It's not really a theorem. It's really an argument. We believe it's a strong argument that the answer is no. So for any gapped local Hamiltonian of either fermions or bosons in 1D, the best you can get in some sense is these Majorana zero modes. That's the only topological degeneracy that you can get. So how to go beyond this Majorana paradigm? Well, okay, one way would be to go to 2D systems. So in particular, the route that I'll be following in this talk is actually to look at boundaries of 2D topological phases, which support a abelian anion. So there would be some topological order in the bulk of the 2D systems. And now I'm going to look at the boundary of the system that would support some edge states. And by gapping that edge state, I would get this edge is an effectively one-dimensional system, but it's an unusual 1D system. It's a 1D system that knows about the topological order in the bulk. And I'll gap out this edge, and I'll get some sort of unusual 1D system that would allow me to actually go beyond this Majorana paradigm. Okay, so that's what I'll be doing. And in particular, the system that I'll be considering is this kind of system. It's a fractional topological insulator, and I'll explain what that is. So that's some 2D topological phase that has some edge states. And these edge states can actually be gapped out by either coupling the edge to a ferromagnet or to a superconductor. So there are kind of two ways of gapping out the edge. And what I'll do is I'll couple some segments of the edge to a superconductor and some segments to a ferromagnet. And at the interface between these two regions, you'll actually get some new kind of zero mode, which supports topological degeneracy and so forth. This is actually a follow-up on a similar proposal by Liang Fu and Charlie Kane, who considered the same thing for the sort of non-fractional 2D topological insulator or quantum spin-hole state. So what's a fractional topological insulator? So that can be just thought of as two copies of the Laughlin quantum Hall state, but it preserves time reversal symmetry. So you have filling fraction of 1 over m, where m is some odd integer for spin-up electrons, and minus 1 over m for spin-down electrons. Okay, so it's like the topological insulator, but a fractional variant of that. That kind of state has been considered by Mike Levin and by Adi Stern, and they show that it's a stable phase in the sense that it has a gapless edge state, which cannot be gapped out unless you break either time reversal or particle hole conservation on the edge. So it has been shown that for the case m equals 1, which is the quantum spin hole state, you actually, with the same setup as here, you actually get Majorana zero modes at the interface between these two types of regions. Okay, so I'll be considering the fractional version of that proposal. Now, before starting to analyze the system, let me just mention that this same kind of setup can actually be realized even without starting from a fractional topological insulator. So introduced mostly for conceptual convenience. But you can do the same thing actually just starting from a Laughlin state, a fractional quantum Hall state. Let me just describe how that can be in principle down. Suppose that we start from a single droplet of a Laughlin state, and we sort of cut a trench through it. We cut it in two. So on either side of this trench, we'll have counterpropagating a chiral edge modes. So this is already starting to look like the edge of a fractional topological insulator. We have these two counterpropagating edge modes there that spin up and spin down. Here it's not, but so the spin here, there's a pseudo spin which describes just on which side of this trench you are. Okay, and then you can couple back these two chiral edge states just by backscattering of electrons. So that would gap out this edge state, essentially healing back this droplet. That's the analog of the ferromagnet that scatters spin up to spin down electrons. Okay, and in this region, you can couple the system to a superconductor that can actually scatter a single Couper pair into one right mover and one left mover electron. That's yet another way of gapping out the edge. Now, of course, that's not so easy to do, because if you think about this Laughlin state as being spin polarized, that won't couple very well to a superconductor. But okay, you can imagine some tricks getting over that. For instance, suppose that this half of the droplet has a positive G factor. This one has a negative G factor, such that the spins are actually opposite. So that would allow you to couple this to a superconductor. So this system is expected to have actually the same kind of physics as the fractional topological insulator. Okay, so this is the kind of setup that I'm imagining here. So I'll be using the language of a fractional topological insulator, but keep in mind that it's not the presence of a fractional topological insulator is actually not essential to any of this story.
Namely, these two edges connected to one chiral mode.
Eventually there's some, right. I mean, this droplet eventually terminates somewhere, but I imagine that that's kind of far away. So, okay. From this to that. Yeah, so here I've sort of, this is my trench. Okay, I've started with a single droplet and cut it in two. So here are my two counterpropagating edge modes. Okay, right. Let me actually start from a physical picture of what's going on in this system. So here's my fractional topological insulator back, and I have two n of these domains, which are alternating, sort of ferromagnetic domain and superconducting domain and so forth, such that I gap out all of the edge mode. The system is now completely gapped. There's a gap both in the bulk and on the edge. But what I'll claim is that actually the ground state of the system is now multiply degenerate. There's some manifold, a finite manifold of ground state whose splitting is exponentially small in the length of these regions, and then a finite gap, and then the rest of the spectrum. Okay, so what I want to do is to count how many of these ground states I have as a function of the number of these domains. Okay, so I'll make a physical argument. The idea is this. If you think about each one of these superconducting domains, so that's surrounded by the ferromagnetic domains, which are actually insulators. So it's like a small superconducting island, essentially. Now, this superconducting region can accommodate some amount of charge. Now, the charge on this region is not well defined because of the fact that it's coupled to an external superconductor, which I imagine is very large. But the charge of this superconducting region is well defined mod 2 for precisely the same reason that the parity is conserved in the wire. So the superconductor can only put in and out charges in units of 2 of Couper pairs. Now, I have some observable, which is this Q2, which is defined mod 2. That's the charge of this region. Now, because of the fact that I'm living on the edge of a Laughlin state, this charge can actually be fractional. So I can change it by fractions of 1 over m by exchanging Laughlin quasi-particles with the bulk. Okay, so what I claim is that this variable qj takes the value n over m, where n is some integer, which can take 2m distinct values from 0 to 2m minus 1. Okay, so basically what I expect that each one of these superconducting domains would actually have, it would support 2m distinct states, which are degenerate. Okay, so now the same kind of logic would actually follow for the ferromagnetic domain. So there I can make the same argument for the spin of this domain. So I have two flavors of electrons corresponding to the two layers, spin up and spin down. Now the ferromagnetic domain is coupled to a large ferromagnet, which actually flips spin up to spin down. So the spin of this domain is only only conserved mod 2, where I'm using units where one electron spin is 1. So I can define the spin of this domain, which can take values which are n over m, where n is between 0 and 2m minus 1. So you would sort of think from this argument that for each one of the domains, I have 2m distinct states. So if I have 2 capital N domains total, I would have 2m to the power 2n quasi-degenerate ground states in the system. Now, that turns out to be not quite true. And the reason is that it turns out that these two variables, the charge and the spin, are actually a non-commuting quantum mechanical variables. So one can show, and I'll argue that in more detail, that if you take these two operators, so e to the I pi si, the spin of the ith domain, and e to the I pi q of the neighboring superconducting domain, they actually don't commute. They satisfy this kind of commutation relation. So they don't commute if they're neighbors. This is what this it tells you. And when you exchange them, you get this phase of e to the I pi over m. Okay, so what that means is that you can choose a basis of this ground state manifold labeled by either the charges of all the superconductors or the spins of all the ferromagnets. But once you do that, the other set of variables is actually not well-defined. Okay, the correct ground state degeneracy is actually of the order of 2m to the power n and not 2n. And if you fix the total charge and total spin, so suppose that the total number of electrons, if you like, in this droplet is fixed, then there are no quasi-particles in the bulk. The number of states actually goes as 2m to the power n minus 1. Okay, so this is the number of approximately degenerate ground states in the system, and then there's a gap, and then the rest of the spectrum. If you think about each one of these interfaces as some sort of anion, then there are 2 capital N of these defects. So you can associate a quantum dimension of square root of 2m for each one of these defects, basically. Okay, you see, for instance, in the case of m equals 1, that's a non-fractional case. That's back to the Fouquet proposal, and then you get that the quantum dimension is actually square root of 2. That corresponds to a Majorana zero mode sitting in each one of these interfaces. So here it seems like there's a Majorana zero mode square root of 2 times square root of m, which is some new type of anion. Okay, so the way to analyze the system slightly more rigorously is to construct an effective low energy model for this edge. And I have basically two counterpropagating edge states, one for spin up and one for spin down. So combined together, they form a non-chiral Langer liquid. So that's the effective low energy model for the system. Okay, and then I need to add to that the coupling to the superconductors and to the ferromagnets. So I have my Langer liquid, and that's coupled I basically add these coupling terms to that are described by these cosines. So I'm using a normalization here where the electron operator is e to the I m times phi plus or minus theta, where plus or minus correspond to spin up or spin down, which is also right or left movers. So because of this factor of m, the term that couples describes the coupling to a superconductor is this cosine of 2m phi. So that just corresponds to creating one right moving and one left moving electron. And it has in front of it this gs, which is a function of x of the position on the perimeter of the system. So GS is assumed to be large in the superconducting regions and the zero essentially in the ferromagnetic regions. And this is the term that describes the coupling to the ferromagnet. So that does the opposite. It's large in the ferromagnetic regions and zero here. And it's actually coupling to the dual variable to theta. Okay, so this is my Hamiltonian. I can't solve that exactly. That's a nonlinear Hamiltonian, but I can make some statements about the solutions of this. So I'm assuming that the cosines are both large. So both GS and GF are large in the superconducting and in the ferromagnetic regions, respectively, such that they essentially pin the two variables phi and theta to the minima of these cosines. So essentially phi n would take the values of pi over m times n, and because of the fact that this is an angular variable, it's only defined mod 2 pi. So this n has two m distinct values. And similarly, theta in the ferromagnetic regions, theta k, the k is the label of the region. So that would take the values of pi over m times n, where n is also defined a mod 2m. Okay, but because of the fact that phi and theta are actually dual variables, they don't commute. They satisfy this kind of commutation relation, and that's why you actually get 2m to the power n states and not 2m to the power 2n. So once again, you can choose a basis in which either the phis or the thetas are well defined, and in that basis, the other set of variables would be strongly fluctuating. So that gives you the same counting of ground states as before. And from this kind of consideration, you can also deduce what's the commutation relation between Q and S, the two sets of variables that I've discussed before. So let me just discuss that briefly. So if I have this sequence of alternating domains, ferromagnetic domains and superconducting domains, then if I consider the charge of this superconductor, I can write that as I'm looking at the exponential of that because Q is defined only mod 2. So e to the I pi Q2 of this region is actually e to the I, the integral of the charge density, which is dx theta, between these two points, x1 and x3. And similarly, if I look at e to the I pi S3, which is the spin of this region, so the spin density is dx phi, so that's given by this integral. So that's just the e to the I times the difference of phi between x4 and x2. So now you see that if I try to commute a Q and S, I'll just pick up the commutation relations between phi and theta. So whenever I have two of these where the endpoints sort of get entangled, then I'll pick up this factor of e to the I pi over m. Okay, and if they're far apart, then they would actually commute. So that's where this commutation relation between Q and S comes from.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I just want to make sure I understand why you couldn't just do the same thing in a one-dimensional line for liquid.
Yes. Yeah. Right. The thing is that What you get here essentially is this kind of Zn symmetry. So if you can get a one-dimensional system that for some reason has that symmetry, then you would get the same counting of ground states. But that symmetry is sort of not very natural in a strictly one-dimensional system. Here it kind of comes out naturally because of the quantization of charges. Basically, this form of the coupling to the superconductor, cosine 2m phi, is basically telling you about the fact that you're living on the edge of a Laughlin state.
Sorry, I thought it's not only that it's natural, but you cannot locally probe this Hungarian state. Right?
Yes. Yeah. So that's,
you have another realization, maybe just conventional.
Yeah, if it comes from some local symmetry, then this degeneracy won't be actually protected. That's another reasoning. Okay, so here the this has this Zn symmetry, but that Zn symmetry just corresponds to conservation of the charge mod a third or mod 1 over m. And that means that you can't actually measure in which state you're in unless you measure the charge of the whole region. So that's a non-local observable.
You meant ZM symmetry.
ZM symmetry, sorry.
The number of islands.
Yes, yeah. Okay, any other questions? Right, so one can actually construct the Hilbert space of the system. So suppose again that we have a finite system with 2n of these domains, construct actually physical operators that act on this Hilbert space. So I consider again this kind of alternating sequence of ferromagnets and superconductors. I can pick a basis in which either the charges or the spins are well defined. Let me pick actually the basis in which the charges are well defined. So I can label each one of the states by the values of these QJs. And also, it turns out that the total spin of the system is also a good quantum number. It actually commutes with these charges. So this is the way that I label my states. And actually, I can define an operator, this chi r and sigma, which corresponds to adding a single Laughlin quasiparticle at the Rth interface. Okay, so that turns out to commute with everything. So I can actually add a single Laughlin quasiparticle with no energy cost at any interface between two of these regions. And what that does is actually it adds a charge of 1 over m. So this is the charge is actually q over m. So it just promotes the qj of the corresponding a neighboring q variable by 1, and it also changes the total spin of the system by sigma. So this has two flavors, up and down, corresponding to a Laughlin quasiparticle in the up or down layer. Okay, so this is a zero mode. This operator turns out to actually be to commute with a Hamiltonian, and these operators the 2m power of these operators is 1, just because the charges this charge and spin are actually only defined mod 2m. In addition, I have to require that they satisfy these kind of commutation relations. So these are the same commutation relations as those of the operators creating a Laughlin quasiparticles on the edges. So they don't commute, they sort of carry this kind of a non-local string. If you compute two of them, they have this factor of e to the I pi over m. So this model is actually a natural realization of a 1D model of parafermions, which was proposed by Paul Findlay. Basically, he considered a 1D model of anions that satisfy precisely these commutation relations. So now, when I've constructed these operators that act on the Hilbert space, I can actually consider ways to couple different interfaces. So suppose that I imagine that this superconducting domain is actually small, such that quasiparticles can tunnel through the bulk between these two interfaces. So I can write down a physical operator that corresponds to that process. So this is this this operator. I create a Laughlin quasiparticle on this interface and then annihilate it there. And if I use the form that I've shown in the previous slide, I can actually get that this the physical operator that corresponds to this process is actually just cosine of pi q, where q is the charge of the corresponding superconducting domain. So between these two interfaces where the quasiparticles tunnel. And similarly, I can also consider a tunneling of quasiparticles between these two domains that have a ferromagnetic region between them. And that would come out to be just a cosine of pi times the spin of the ferromagnetic domain between these two interfaces. Okay, in addition to a description of the Hilbert space, I can also now describe physical processes of fractional quasiparticles tunneling between these two interfaces. And the question is how to actually manipulate now this the Hilbert space, this zero energy Hilbert space. So I want to see if these kind of anions have anything that resembles braiding, actually. What I'll do is the following. So I'll consider once again this a system that has a total of two n domains, and I'll imagine that I can turn on and off at will these kind of quasi-particle tunneling amplitudes between different domains. So suppose that the system is kind of elastic, and I can sort of squash it around and make these two domain walls, for instance, close to each other, such that fractional quasi-particles can tunnel through the bulk between here and there. So what I actually have is some time-dependent Hamiltonian in this zero-energy or a low-energy Hilbert space. And the question is whether I can mimic braiding doing that way. I'll sort of follow the logic of Jason and Alicia et al., who did a similar thing for the Majorana case. Now, you might be worried that when I turn on a coupling between different domain walls here, I actually lift partially the ground state degeneracy that I've been discussing. So to be able to talk about braiding, what I have to make sure is that the ground state degeneracy remains fixed throughout this braiding process. So I have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, and I have to make sure that at every given moment, the ground state degeneracy is actually fixed, it's actually constant. Okay, and it turns out that you can show that that's the case if you couple at every given moment any three domain walls in an arbitrary way. Generically, what you'll get is that there's a fixed ground state degeneracy. Essentially, you remove one factor of 2 over m. If you have six domains here, you would without any coupling, you would get 2m to the power 3. If you couple at most three domains, you would get 2m to the power 2. But that's independent of the precise way that you've coupled these three domain walls, as long as you allow only one species to tunnel at every given moment. It turns out that if you allow both of them to tunnel, that's not the case. So I'll basically limit myself to this type of tunneling. There's only spin up can tunnel and not spin down, but I don't have to be able to control precisely what's the Hamiltonian in the spin up sector. Okay, there's some Hamiltonian. But only three domains are coupled at any given moment. Okay, that's my rule. So I'll introduce some sort of protocol. So I have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, which is of this form. So there's some tunneling amplitude between a interface number I to interface number j with spin-up quasi-particles. Okay, there's some amplitudes that depend on time adiabatically, and then I can consider some explicit protocol. So I have four interfaces, and I start from a case where one and two are coupled, so that there's this kind of a hopping between them. And then I adiabatically turn on this coupling between two and four, and at the same time, I turn off the coupling between one and two. Okay, and you can sort of imagine that what that does is before I turned on this coupling between two and four, I had two zero modes sitting at three and four. Now, when I turn this coupling on, I sort of annihilate this one, but I've created a new zero mode here. So essentially, what I've done is I've pushed this one over here. Okay, and now okay. So this is what this process essentially does. Okay, and then I can go on. So this is my starting point of the next process, and I turn on this coupling so that essentially pushes the anion from here to there. And then I need to close the cycle, so I turn on this one back. That pushes this one to here. And at the end of this process, my Hamiltonian has gone back to its original form. But it turns out that the ground state of the system has not. Okay, so essentially, what this does is if you follow what the anions do, it sort of interchanges 3 and 4. Okay, so that was our intuition for this process. And also, I mean, that's very similar to the protocol that was proposed for Majorana wires. But one can actually compute explicitly the adiabatic evolution due to this kind of Hamiltonian. And from that, one actually gets a non-trivial unitary matrix that corresponds to braiding in the system. And it turns out, indeed, that the the braiding matrix doesn't depend on the precise details of this Hamiltonian. As long as you don't cross some special degeneracy points in this parameter space, the result is actually independent of the precise details. And this is the actual result. So if you braid, if you do this particle interchanging these two anions, so 3 and 4, you get this kind of unitary matrix. So that's unitary matrix only depends on the charge variable, which is between 3 and 4. This is this Q2. And it's just given by this phase, e to the I pi m over 2 times Q2 squared. And if you write Q2 in this form, it's an little q2, which is an integer between 0 and 2m minus 1 over m, then it actually has this form. Okay, now you could also interchange, say, 2 and 3, some other two interfaces, and then you would get the same kind of unitary matrix that depends now, instead of Q2, on S2, on the spin variable of the corresponding ferromagnetic region. And that's why this is non-abelian. So the S2 and the Q2 don't commute, and therefore you get that these unitary matrices actually non-abelian. For example, if you take m equals 3, so a one-third Laughlin state, you can write this a variable Q2 as 2p plus 3q, where p is between 0 and 2, and q is between 0 and 1. And then just writing this phase, you can write it as a product of a phase that depends only on Q and a phase that depends only on P. Now the Q dependent part is just the braiding rule for Majorana fermions, actually. So Q is either 0 or 1, and P has these three values. So actually this braiding matrix is a tensor product of two parts. One of them is actually just Majorana braiding, and the other one is something new, is something non-Majorana. Okay, so the Hilbert space actually decomposes into two sectors. One of them is just Majorana fermions, and the other one is this Z3 a new object. Okay, so it turns out that these braiding matrices are actually braiding, so they form a representation of the braid group. One can check that they satisfy the Young-Baxter relations. So basically, if you take three of these interfaces and perform this kind of sequence of braidings, basically you braid 1 and 2, and then 2 and 3, and then 1 and 2 again. That's the same as braiding 2 and 3, and then 1 and 2, and then 2 and 3 again. That's a consistency relation required from this kind of topology of these space-time pictures. Okay, so now in the remaining maybe a few minutes, let me argue that there's a three. Okay, yeah. what did I say? I said few. Okay. There's actually a sort of more general way to understand where does this braiding rule come from. One can understand it more abstractly if one assumes that this comes from some underlying 2D theory. There is some underlying 2D theory that has these kind of defects as its anions. So to go through this argument, I'll have to introduce the concept of a topological spin of an anion. So this is a phase that one gets when you basically twist an anion around its axis. It's like the internal angular momentum that an anion has. Now that corresponds to this kind of process. This is a word line of an anion. So suppose that you have a single anion, and then you create a pair of anion and anti-anion out of the vacuum, and then you interchange the anion with the other anion that you've created, and then you annihilate this one with that one. So that actually corresponds to twisting the anion around itself. Okay, and one gets this kind of topological phase in a 2D topological theory. Now, in my theory, there would be two types of particles. So one of them is X. This is my domain role. This is the new type of anion. And one of them is Q, and the other one is Q. That's an abelian particle. That's just the charge. Now, I have this kind of fusing rule. So if I fuse two of these x's, I get basically a Q. Okay, I get an abelian charge, which can take a value between 0 and 2m minus 1. And the Qs are just abelian charges. So they just add in this way. So when I fuse Q1 and Q2, I just get a new sort of Q particle, which has the value Q1 plus Q2 mod 2m. Okay, now each one of these two particles would have its own topological spin. So I can consider the topological spin of the x particle that corresponds to this space-time trajectory, and also have the topological spin of the Q particle. Now, a Q particle is just made out of two x's. I can describe the Q particle as the result of fusing two x's. So the topological spin of the Q particle is just described by this kind of space-time a trajectory of two of these x's. Okay, so now it turns out that if you examine the topological spin of the Q particle, just by deforming things smoothly, you can deform this trajectory into that one. Okay, so just by moving these loops around. So this corresponds to two x particles. Each one of them undergoes this kind of twist, which would give you the topological spin of the x particle. And then you have this double exchange of the two x particles. So the claim is that these two processors are topologically equivalent, so they should give you the same phase. Okay, now, right, each one of these x's is the x particle. Okay, so from this you get that the theta q, the topological spin of the q particle, should be equal to theta x squared, just twice the topological spin of the single x particle, times uq squared, where uq is the unitary matrix that corresponds to an exchange of two x particles that fuse into q. Okay, so you do that twice here, so that's the reason for the squared. Now if you analyze the topological spin of the q particle, because of the fact that the q particle is abelian, and because of the fact that you see that the topological spin of the q particle just corresponds to actually four exchanges of these two lines, one can deduce that that has to go like e to the I some parameter alpha times q squared. Okay, so it turns out that this alpha has to take the value of pi over m. That comes from the Young-Baxter equations, if you just plug this in. From that, you actually get u of q up to a global phase. So even if you don't know what this theta x is, that gives you that a u of q has to go like the square root of basically this object, which would go like e to the I alpha over 2 times q squared, which is what we got from the explicit calculation. Okay, so with that, let me conclude. So this is sort of a new paradigm for non-Majorana phases that can live on the edges of gapped 2D topological states. In this particular case, one gets these new objects that have this kind of grading role. And with that, let me thank you for your attention.
Some questions. So if you split off the I-Z sector, just take whatever left over.
Yes.
So in your theory, you have only one interface, one kind of particle.
Yes. Right.
The question, because we have a different kind of thinking. So can you consider the interface with the X-ray electron as a different particle? So in the theory, we are thinking there's a boson which is missing. So I wonder if you take your interface and then attach another X-ray electron, you can say this is a different particle or something like that.
Yeah, so I mean, right. So I think this is, okay, I mean, this is essentially what we're getting. So the
But you don't consider that as a different particle. In your theory, that's a single, it's the same thing, right?
It's the same thing, but since the hyperspace of naturally decomposes into two sectors, I can actually consider that as a different sector. So I mean, each interface can have either even or odd number of electrons, and then on top of that, I have this Z3 sort of degree of freedom. I'm not sure that's exactly what you're asking.
Yeah, Well, I'm just asking, you know, you have three kinds of interface, or you have six kinds of interfaces in your theory for M equals three.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that there's only one type of interface, but each two can fuse into six states, and then that six I can think about the two times three.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean it's more like I can start without the Ising part, and then consider two types of interfaces. One is the the natural interfaces, and the one that I get from adding a single Majorana zero mode. I would say, okay, maybe one can say it that way.
The Yang-Baxter equation you showed, I thought that was well-defined only up to a phase, or is that exactly?
No, that's modiphase.
Modiphase.
Yes, yeah. So right, there's a subtlety here which I haven't mentioned, which is that actually this braiding matrix, it's well-defined up to a phase. In general, because there's a global phase here which I can't control, in particular there are sort of various ways to do this braid, and each one gives you a different braiding matrix up to a linear term in Q here. So it's really Q squared plus M times Q. Okay, right.
So to analyze this example very nicely, where you take a fractional protopole, fractional topological sphere, and then have this interface with some magnet. Is this a general theme? Is there a general understanding? If you take some topological phase with some symmetry,
yes.
Let's say, I don't know, something else, Z2 gate theory, Zn gate theory with some symmetries.
Yes.
And then you break, introduce domain walls which break symmetry in various ways.
Yeah.
What kind of things can happen?
Yes. I think that. I'm only starting to get an understanding of this. I think the general answer, there many people in this room have thought about this recently. So there are various ways to gap out the edge, and each one you can actually annihilate a certain type of quasi particle. Mm-hmm. So that kind of relates to Michael's Michael's talk. So that actually allows you to identify a set of non-commuting symmetries that the system would have. You consider processes in which you create some sort of quasi-particle from one gapped interface, annihilate it at the next type of interface of that kind, and then you have another process where there's a neighboring interface with another type of gap, and there's a different type of anion that you can create. So that allows you to construct an algebra of operators that would allow you to identify the graph degeneracy, for instance.
So there's a general answer that's known? Or?
Yeah, I don't think this has been...
We just wrote a paper last week.
Okay.
Right.
So it is, something is known.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, maybe this is a good point to thank Erez again.